You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the No Man's Sky edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, we wonder, are we living in a simulation? The Scout Mindset, and a long look at race, natural or social construct. Let's begin episode 351.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism to everyday issues. Life and reality across sorts, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of stars. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome, tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week in Web Wisdom, we start off with a reflection on No Man's Sky, and the idea that we are all living in a computer simulation. Let's listen in.
Here's an idea. No Man's Sky can help us think through the question of whether or not we are currently living in a simulation. Soon, glob willing, the universe-exploring video game No Man's Sky will be released. Developed by Hello Games and skippered by Sean Murray, No Man's Sky has been an object of wonder, curiosity, and impatience since its announcement in 2013. If you've missed the hype, here is the intergalactic dirt. No Man's Sky is gigantic. Players traverse an entire simulated universe exploring procedurally generated planets. There's practically no limit to what you can see. Murray estimates that players will see maybe 1% of what the game is capable of generating. And on top of that, much of the appearance and behavior of things in that universe, planets, plants, creatures, light itself, is emergent. The creators didn't decide how stuff looks or behaves on a planet-by-planet basis. They made systems and rules that generate stuff and decide what happens when various stuffs mingle. Appearances and outcomes aren't designed. They emerge. Like one of my all-time favorite games, Dwarf Fortress, even the creators themselves can't say exactly what'll happen. Unlike Dwarf Fortress, though, No Man's Sky is beautiful. Okay, I take it back. Dwarf Fortress is beautiful too, but No Man's Sky is lush, naturalistic, detailed, even occasionally lifelike. The particulars of how they did this are beyond the scope of this video, but Atlantic wrote a great piece and Game Show did a video about it last year. I hope it suffices to say that the answer is math, algorithms, formulas, processing power. So all of this raises two questions. The first we've asked before. If math makes environments, does that mean math is a feature of the universe? Our second question is the following. If we're able to simulate universes of massive lifelike complexity, like that of No Man's Sky, within our universe, should we wonder or worry that our own massive lifelike universe is itself simulated? And if it is, what does that mean? That Atlantic article that I mentioned scratches the surface of this idea, but we're gonna try to get near the bedrock, or at least the substratum. If you know where we're headed with this, I think, simulation or not, the argument alone has an important function which No Man's Sky can help us think through. If you don't know where we're headed, hold on to your potentially simulated butts. Between 2001 and 2003, philosopher Nick Bostrom put forth his influential simulation argument. He claims our lives and universe are potentially a computer simulation run by a post-human civilization, one in the distant future and much more technologically advanced than our own. Our universe could be what he calls an ancestor simulation, a simulation of the entire mental history of humankind. So how does Bostrom actually get to this conclusion? Actually, he comes to three exhaustive, mutually exclusive conclusions, meaning we'll necessarily arrive at one of these three outcomes and only one of these three outcomes. Those outcomes are, one, the number of human-level civilizations that reach a post-human stage is practically zero. Two, the number of post-human civilizations that are interested in running ancestor simulations is practically zero. Or three, our universe, including our lives and experiences, is simulated. Bostrom lays out his reasoning pretty succinctly. The original paper is pretty readable. Boop. If you want to check it out. But basically, if humanity doesn't go extinct, which is roughly speaking his outcome number one, the rapid increase in the realism of simulations in our own time, No Man's Sky, suggests that super future simulations would be exceptionally realistic, especially if we ever get to the point where we're operating planetary mass computers, if we aren't already. And what's more, as our ability to simulate grows, it seems our interest does too. In order for outcome two to be the case, something would have to dissuade post-humans from running a potentially infinite number of powerful simulations, including ancestor simulations. As of right now, it seems likely that if we can, we will. And if we will, does that mean that we, you and me, right now, are simulated?
I'm a computer.
Bostrom himself puts it at about a 20% chance, but lots of smart folks say, yeah, definitely. Futurist Ray Kurzweil questions whether there's even a distinction between reality and simulation. Elon Musk recently said the chances that we are not living in a simulation are one in a billion. Also that he and his brother have agreed to not discuss the simulation argument in hot tubs makes me wonder what the Musk family holiday get-togethers are like.
We would ban such conversations if we were ever in a hot tub.
So at this point, you may be thinking, okay, sure, maybe No Man's Sky is a step in this direction, but yeah, this sounds like something that you argue with your brother about, potentially in a hot tub, I guess. Does any of this really matter? The simulation argument does have implications, it turns out. One could be that all of this is literally immaterial, and whatever great mistakes we make again and again won't be so bad that a little flip of the reset button wouldn't set it all right. Another is, if we, by some chance, end up the ones creating civilization simulations, is there some moral slash ethical imperative to create a lifelike simulation better than our reality? And if so, how do we deal with the existence of simulations better than the real world, which is especially interesting given the recent rise of virtual reality? Also implied by the simulation argument is the existence of, brace yourselves, a higher power. If we're in a simulation, the simulation must have a creator, or a programmer, or at the very least, maintenance staff. Bostrom is quick to point out that these figures would probably be naturalistic. They wouldn't be transcendent beings of pure light, unless evolution gets real weird real quick, but still, they would be literally creators. This does something really interesting, I think. The idea of reality reset switches better than worlds and creator figures, especially. It all turns the world, our world, the universe, really, a highly complex thing about which we are constantly developing a deeply rational and scientific understanding, into something like a story, like a sci-fi or fantasy story, or video game, as the case may be. How so? Well, No Man's Sky exists because we understand how the information that flows in an endless sea of for real natural systems gives rise to their emergent characteristics and interactions. Whether they're made by math or not, we can use that math to faithfully or near faithfully model those things. And those models are astounding. Where the forest near where I grew up is just a forest, a No Man's Sky forest is an enchanted forest. Its artificiality makes it special, sort of magical. The environments of No Man's Sky are enchanted because we, humans, made them. A human is its creator figure, or at the very least, its maintenance staff. The simulation argument, I think, functions similarly to No Man's Sky. It marries the rational and the enchanted, but on an infinite scale, and it provides access to two potentially conflicting attitudes. On the one hand, it supports a scientific understanding of our world. It doesn't replace physics or biology. It explains their existence via simulation, another deeply scientific process, one involving computers, and they're the most rational of all the things. They're built on logic, literally. But on the other hand, though we may follow the empirical logic from computers are powerful and make simulations to computers will get more powerful and make better simulations, we end up at a conclusion that is ultimately and inarguably fantastic. Maybe that real forest is artificial. Maybe we're simulated. It's an argument for a kind of techno-moralism, transcendence, and even creator figure, which is rooted in technology and experience. It enchants reality. Of course, some folks aren't so enchanted. Talking with Inverse philosopher and neuroscientist Ned Block says, consciousness is necessarily embodied, having to do with, quote, electrochemical processes in the brain, something more complex than even super future quantum computers could do, he says. And besides, he also says, just as a simulation of a rainstorm isn't wet, there's no reason that a simulation of conscious experience would be conscious experience. Like a good science fiction story, maybe the simulation argument just takes what is the case and extrapolates out to what appears likely, even if it's not. And, I mean, even if it were likely, the weird truth may be that ancestor simulations sit at the crossroads of complicated, expensive, and boring for whoever the audience is. My hometown nature preserve isn't enchanting because I live it. No Man's Sky's forest is enchanting because I play it. That's an important distinction. No Man's Sky may be notable for how big and detailed and potentially lifelike it is, but in order to justify the resources it took to make it and to keep it running, it's gonna have to be good and entertaining, which, I mean, time will tell, I guess. Maybe I'm being cynical, but I think the same would go for ancestor simulations. Following the simulation argument's own logic, computers will become more powerful, sure, but also more power hungry. US data centers alone tripled their power needs from 2000 to 2013, so we can imagine that the resources needed to simulate, you know, everything would be unimaginable. And sure, okay, maybe someday post-scarcity free energy, well-funded research, the simulation is the power source and Neo is the one there is no spoon, but now we are stacking speculative super future scenarios, so heck it, let's just all agree to become transcendent beings of pure light. Seriously though, I just think it's more likely that an ancestor simulation would be ad-supported. You know, like reality.
Hi, it's Fitz with Slap Chop. You're gonna be in a great mood all day.
Simulated existence is most likely, I think, if it's appealing. And life, our lives at least, they may be dramatic, but they aren't entertaining. The growing intricacy of modern video games supports this point about as much as it supports the technological aspects of the simulation argument itself. For all their visual complexity, there's a point of diminishing returns when it comes to mechanical or environmental complexity. Writing for Gamasutra, RimWorld developer Tynan Sylvester put it pretty well. He says, we can't blindly simulate everything because most things are boring and people can't understand over-complex systems anyways. Writing for Backchannel, Logan Hill puts it very succinctly and says, I can't imagine an exec who would greenlight this planet. Really, for most people, deep down, I don't think the simulation argument is about what's actual, though it's often dressed that way. I think we're talking conveniently about what's virtual. We're talking, as Michael Saylor put it in his book of the same name, as if it were the case. The simulation argument brings our lived experiences closer to No Man's Sky or Minecraft or, well, hopefully not Dwarf Fortress. The simulation argument enchants the actual world like it's a video game without requiring we sacrifice our modern, science-based, or at least science-themed, sensibilities. No Man's Sky, at the same time, provides a whole universe interior to our own, a literally virtual one to explore from the comfort of our homes. Imagine what's next, perhaps living in that universe. No Man's Sky provides a view to endless simulated planets, sure, but also a view to games which function like life. And who doesn't want life to be like a game?
Next up, why you think you're right, even if you're wrong. A look at how different mindsets help prevent cognitive bias.
I'd like you to imagine for a moment that you're a soldier in the heat of battle. Maybe you're a Roman foot soldier, or a medieval archer, or maybe you're a Zulu warrior. Regardless of your time and place, there are some things that are constant. Your adrenaline is elevated, and your actions are stemming from these deeply ingrained reflexes, reflexes rooted in a need to protect yourself and your side and to defeat the enemy. So now, I'd like you to imagine playing a very different role, that of the scout. So the scout's job is not to attack or defend. The scout's job is to understand. The scout is the one going out, mapping the terrain, identifying potential obstacles. And the scout may hope to learn that, say, there's a bridge in a convenient location across a river. But above all, the scout wants to know what's really there as accurately as possible. And in a real, actual army, both the soldier and the scout are essential. But you can also think of each of these roles as a mindset, a metaphor for how all of us process information and ideas in our daily lives. And what I'm going to argue today is that having good judgment, making accurate predictions, making good decisions, is mostly about which mindset you're in. So, to illustrate these mindsets in action, I'm going to take you back to 19th century France, where this innocuous-looking piece of paper launched one of the biggest political scandals in history. It was discovered in 1894 by officers in the French General Staff, and it was torn up in a waste paper basket, but when they pieced it back together, they discovered that someone in their ranks had been selling military secrets to Germany. So they launched a big investigation, and their suspicions quickly converged on this man, Albert Dreyfus. He had a sterling record, no past history of wrongdoing, no motive, as far as they could tell. But Dreyfus was the only Jewish officer at that rank in the army. And unfortunately, at this time, the French army was highly anti-Semitic. So they compared Dreyfus's handwriting to that on the memo and concluded that it was a match, even though outside professional handwriting experts were much less confident in the similarity. But never mind that. They went and searched Dreyfus's apartment, looking for any signs of espionage. They went through his files, and they didn't find anything. And this just convinced them more that Dreyfus was not only guilty, but sneaky as well, because clearly he had hidden all of the evidence before they had managed to get to it. Next, they went and looked through his personal history for any incriminating details. They talked to his teachers. They found that he had studied foreign languages in school, which clearly showed a desire to conspire with foreign governments in later in life. His teachers also said that Dreyfus had a good memory, you know, known for having a good memory, which was highly suspicious, right? You know, because a spy has to remember a lot of things. So the case went to trial, and Dreyfus was found guilty. And afterwards, they took him out into this public square and ritualistically tore his insignia from his uniform and broke his sword in two. This was called the degradation of Dreyfus. And they sentenced him to life imprisonment on the aptly named Devil's Island, which is this barren rock off the coast of South America. So there he went, and there he spent his days alone, writing letters and letters to the French government, begging them to reopen his case so they could discover his innocence. But for the most part, France considered the matter closed. So one thing that's really interesting to me about the Dreyfus affair is this question of why the officers were so convinced that Dreyfus was guilty. I mean, you might even assume that they were setting him up, that they were intentionally framing him, but historians don't think that's what happened. As far as we can tell, the officers genuinely believed that the case against Dreyfus was strong, which, you know, makes you wonder, what does it say about the human mind that we can find such paltry evidence to be compelling enough to convict a man? Well, this is a case of what scientists call motivated reasoning. It's this phenomenon in which our unconscious motivations, our desires and fears, shape the way we interpret information. So some information, some ideas feel like our allies, and we want them to win, we want to defend them. And other information or ideas are the enemy, and we want to shoot them down. So this is why I call motivated reasoning soldier mindset. And probably most of you have never persecuted a French Jewish officer for high treason, I assume. But maybe you've followed sports or politics. So you might have noticed that when the referee judges that your team committed a foul, for example, you're highly motivated to find reasons why he's wrong. But if he judges that the other team committed a foul, awesome, that's a good call. Let's not examine it too closely. Or maybe you've read an article or a study that examined some controversial policy, like capital punishment. And as researchers have demonstrated, if you support capital punishment and the study shows that it's not effective, then you're highly motivated to find all the reasons why the study was poorly designed. But if it shows that capital punishment works, awesome, it's a good study. And vice versa, if you don't support capital punishment, same thing. Our judgment is just strongly influenced, unconsciously, by which side we want to win. And this is ubiquitous. This shapes how we think about our health, our relationships, how we decide how to vote, what we consider fair or ethical. And what's most scary to me about motivated reasoning or soldier mindset is how unconscious it is. You know, we can think we're being objective and fair-minded and still wind up ruining the life of an innocent man. However, fortunately for Dreyfus, his story is not over. This is Colonel Picquart. He's another high-ranking officer in the French army. And like most people, he assumed Dreyfus was guilty. Also, like most people in the army, he was at least casually anti-Semitic. But at a certain point, Picquart began to suspect, what if we're all wrong about Dreyfus? And what happened was that he had discovered evidence that the spying for Germany had continued even after Dreyfus was in prison. And he had also discovered that another officer in the army had handwriting that perfectly matched the memo, much closer than Dreyfus's handwriting. So he brought these discoveries to his superiors, but to his dismay, they either didn't care or came up with elaborate rationalizations to explain his findings, like, all you've really shown, Picquart, is that there's another spy who learned how to mimic Dreyfus's handwriting, and he, you know, picked up the torch of spying after Dreyfus left. But Dreyfus is still guilty. Eventually, Picquart managed to get Dreyfus exonerated, but it took him 10 years, and for part of that time, he himself was in prison for the crime of disloyalty to the army. So, you know, a lot of people feel like Picquart can't really be the hero of this story because he was an anti-Semite, and that's bad, which I agree with. But personally, for me, the fact that Picquart was anti-Semitic actually makes his actions more admirable because he had the same prejudices, the same reasons to be biased as his fellow officers, but his motivation to find the truth and uphold it just trumped all of that. So to me, Picquart is a poster child for what I call scout mindset. It's the drive not to make one idea win or another lose, but just to see what's really there as honestly and accurately as you can, even if it's not pretty or convenient or pleasant. And this mindset is what I'm personally passionate about, and what I've spent the last few years examining and trying to figure out what causes scout mindset. You know, why are some people, sometimes at least, able to cut through their own prejudices and biases and motivations and just try to see the facts and the evidence as objectively as they can? And the answer is emotional. So just as soldier mindset is rooted in emotions like defensiveness or tribalism, scout mindset is too. It's just rooted in different emotions. So for example, scouts are curious. They're more likely to say that they feel pleasure when they learn new information or an itch to solve a puzzle. They're more likely to feel intrigued when they encounter something that contradicts their expectations. Scouts also have different values. They're more likely to say that they think it's virtuous to test your own beliefs, and they're less likely to say that someone who changes his mind seems weak. And above all, scouts are grounded, which means that their self-worth as a person isn't tied to how right or wrong they are about any particular topic. So, you know, they can believe that capital punishment works, and if studies come out showing that it doesn't, they can say, looks like I might be wrong. Doesn't mean I'm bad or stupid, you know? So these traits, this cluster of traits, is what researchers have found, and I've also found anecdotally, predicts good judgment. And the key takeaway I want to leave you with about those traits is that they're primarily not about how smart you are or about how much you know. In fact, they don't correlate very much with IQ at all. They're about how you feel. So there's a quote that I keep coming back to by Saint-Exupéry. He's the author of The Little Prince. And he said, if you want to build a ship, don't drum up your men to collect wood and give orders and distribute the work. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. In other words, I claim, if we want to really improve our judgment as individuals and as societies, what we need most is not more instruction in logic or rhetoric or probability or economics, even though those things are quite valuable. But what we most need to use those principles well is scout mindset. We need to change the way we feel. We need to learn how to feel proud instead of ashamed when we notice we might have been wrong about something. We need to learn how to feel intrigued instead of defensive when we encounter some information that contradicts our beliefs. So the question I want to leave you with is, what do you most yearn for? Do you yearn to defend your own beliefs? Or do you yearn to see the world as clearly as you possibly can? Thank you.
We're going to pause for a quick break.
Support for CITR comes from Golden Voiced, welcoming Icelandic trio Sigurós on the 2016 North American Tour on Sunday, September 18th at the Queen Elizabeth Theatre. Sigurós tickets are on sale now at Ticketmaster.ca.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 FM, Vancouver, Canada. And we're back. Next up, we have a four-part look at race. First off, racial ontology, or what is the nature of the idea of race? Let's listen and learn.
Hello, my name is David Miguel Gray. I teach philosophy at Colgate University, and today I want to talk to you about race. In particular, I want to talk about the question, what kind of things are races if they exist? Now, to many people, this sounds like a funny question to ask because it just seems obvious that races exist. Well, today, I'm not going to talk about the answers philosophers, scientists, and social theorists have given to the question. That will be the topic of the next three videos. Rather, I'm going to talk about why it's so hard to figure out how to approach this question. In particular, I'm going to focus on three closely related challenges to developing an account of race: the domain problem, the expertise and deference problem, and the third, the mismatch problem, or as it is more commonly known, the mismatch argument. The domain problem is best captured by the question, if there are races, what kind of thing are they? For instance, we might think that races are natural categories, and that for someone to be a member of a race is for them to have a set of natural properties, some of which are shared with other members of the same race. Natural properties are properties that exist in the world independently of the way we categorize it. So, for instance, having the property of being a hat is not a natural property, whereas having the property of being made of wool is. Let's say that if this is the right way to think of races, then the right domain from which to study races would be the natural domain. This was a common approach to race in the 19th and 20th centuries. Today, some philosophers view race as being explainable in terms of a subset of natural properties we refer to as biological properties. But around the end of the 20th century, we started to see the development of arguments which suggested that race is not a natural phenomenon, but a socio-historical one. What follows from this is that the important racial properties associated with race are not natural, but socio-historical. For instance, in W.E.B. Du Bois's groundbreaking 1897 speech, The Conservation of Races, he tells us that while races transcend scientific definition, they nevertheless are clearly defined to the eye of the historian and the sociologist. That might be a bit hard to understand, so let me give you an example. In the U.S., we have quite a few doctors. When they are working, they are normally easily identifiable. They often wear white coats with stethoscopes around their necks. They work in hospitals and universities, and often talk in a way that suggests a high level of medical expertise. And in order to be a practicing doctor in the U.S., you have to graduate from an accredited medical school, complete a residency program, and obtain a license to practice in a particular state or jurisdiction. But the fact that doctors have the properties of having medical degrees and licenses depend on the existence of institutions which can be explained historically and socially. And while doctors and virtually all other people share in natural properties like having a brain, the properties that make a person a doctor are social properties. Because of this, doctors can be thought of as socio-historical constructs. Now, there is a big difference between being considered to be of a particular race and being considered to be a doctor. But the idea is that racial properties are largely determined by our history and social institutions. Since W.E.B. Du Bois' speech, the idea that race falls within the domain of sociology and history has been increasing in popularity, and I think I can safely say is the dominant view among academics, or at the very least, sociologists and historians. Another possibility is that racial properties are not just natural properties or socio-historical properties, but a combination of these two. If this is the case, then to get a grasp on what races are may involve research in both the natural and the socio-historical domain. So what we can gather from this discussion is that figuring out what races are seems really difficult because there is still substantial debate about what is the proper domain of investigation. So that's the domain problem. A related problem is the expertise and deference problem. The idea is roughly this. Language seems to work in such a way that there are lots of specialty terms that we can meaningfully use without being in possession of much information. For instance, I might say that my friend Julio has tuberculosis without being able to tell you what tuberculosis is. I know that it's not good to have tuberculosis and that it's a medical condition. But this doesn't distinguish tuberculosis from lots of other conditions that are medical and also bad. So if I can't distinguish tuberculosis from other bad medical conditions, in virtue of what do I get to say I'm speaking meaningfully about tuberculosis and not, let's say, cancer? To answer this question, the theory of semantic deference claims that I can speak meaningfully about tuberculosis because there are experts in my community, namely research doctors, that do know what tuberculosis is and how to tell it apart from other bad medical conditions. As the philosopher Hilary Putnam once said, we should think of language less like a singular tool and more like the running of a complex steamship in which many of us have different and cooperative roles to play. So now that we have an understanding of the role of semantic deference and expertise and the role of fixing the meaning of medical terms, we can ask, do racial terms work in the same way as medical terms like tuberculosis? It does seem hard for many of us to say much meaningfully about race, so maybe we can just defer to race experts in the way I deferred to research doctors in the tuberculosis example. This seems like a good solution, so what's the problem? For starters, experts normally occupy a domain, and as we've already seen, it's not clear in which domain we should locate our experts. Would we consult a biologist, a historian, a sociologist, or a philosopher? Additionally, there is little agreement even within these domains as to how to characterize races. Take the naturalist domain. Are races the kind of things in which all members share some sort of underlying essential properties? Should races be primarily defined in terms of ancestral relations or geographic locations? Or perhaps races can be picked out by referring to groups that have a higher frequency of non-coding DNA in common. Even though we are working within a singular domain, there is still massive disagreement on what races are within that domain. In short, it's not clear there is a unified group of experts to defer to, even if we can solve the domain problem. So we don't seem to have a solution to the expertise and deference problem. Finally, there's the mismatch problem, or as it has been coined by philosopher Ron Malin, the mismatch argument. Here's the problem. Race is an area that we need to investigate and that normally involves some people specializing in race issues. And during such investigations, specialists sometimes come up with highly specialized definitions of what race is and what racial terms pick out in the world. If the specialists or experts tell us that races are biologically isolated populations of individuals, then it might turn out that some of the things we thought were races actually aren't races, while other things we thought weren't races actually are. As the philosopher Anthony Appiah suggests, the Amish might meet this definition of race, even though we don't tend to think of Amish as a race. The worry here is that what experts tell us racial terms pick out ends up deviating substantially from what we normally think racial terms pick out. And if this happens, then our experts' accounts of what race is may not match up with our ordinary account of race and all the important explanatory work such ordinary accounts of race play in our everyday lives. The domain problem, the expertise and deference problem, and the mismatch problem are three problems that any account of race will need to deal with. In the next set of entries on racial ontology, I'll talk about some of the major positions on race and their advantages and disadvantages.
Next we have, is there a naturalistic explanation for race? Let's find out.
Is race something we can fully explain in terms of the natural world around us? Welcome to part two of the four-part series on racial ontology, A Guide for the Perplexed. In the first part, we discussed three general problems that make giving any account of race difficult. Those were the domain problem, the expertise and deference problem, and the mismatch problem. For part two of this series, I want to look at a particular set of theories that we can call naturalist theories of race. While the term naturalism is used in many different ways, we can think of naturalism as the view that properties within a particular domain of investigation are physical properties. For instance, there are lots of domains of inquiry where we may believe in non-physical properties. We might believe in numbers, which are a kind of abstract object as they aren't located in space or time. Or you might think that moral properties, like the wrongness of pushing someone in front of a car, is a non-physical property. That is, if we look at all the physical stuff involved in pushing someone in front of a car, for example, the car, the person, the act of pushing, you might think that the wrongness is not among those physical parts. If one were to be a naturalist about moral properties, they might claim that the moral properties are among the physical parts. But leaving that difficult debate on moral naturalism aside, we can say that to be a naturalist about race is to say that racial properties just are physical properties. If you are wondering what, aside from physical properties, racial properties could be, one possible alternative is that racial properties are social properties. Social properties are those that are dependent on human acts and decisions, while properties that we consider physical are thought to be independent of human acts and decisions. Take an example of an object like the Great Sphinx of Giza. The property of being made of limestone is a natural property of the statue. Limestone isn't something that is the result of human actions or decision-making. However, the fact that this object is a statue isn't a natural property. Someone decided to shape the limestone into a couchant sphinx. So what's the upshot of thinking of races as being composed of natural properties? Well, that means that races exist independently of any human actions or decision-making processes. Races are something in the world that natural scientists can investigate and discover. The opposing view would be that races are created by people, which will be the topic of the third video. So now, we have an idea both of what it means to think of races in terms of natural properties, as well as what that view can be contrasted with. This leads us to the question, which natural properties? For the naturalist, there are a lot of different accounts of what race could be. Before the 20th century, when race seemed to be studied primarily by natural historians, the following features were associated with racial naturalism. 1. Races have either natural essences or some set of observable natural properties that are shared by all or most members of that race. 2. These natural properties are inheritable. 3. These natural properties place races into a hierarchical system where they can be differentiated in terms of physical, behavioral, intellectual, and moral characteristics. I'm not going to spend any time on these older views, as they aren't currently held for any scientific reason. Nowadays, they only pop up infrequently among those who have a limited and/or motivated understanding of biological properties. If you would like to read more about this, I'd highly recommend Michael Udell, Dorothy Roberts, Robert Dessau, and Sarah Tishkoff's Taking Race Out of Genetics, Ned Block's How Heritability Misleads About Race, and Alan Templeton's Biological Races in Humans. This leads us to what some philosophers like Josh Glasgow have called the new biology of race. Unlike the old biology of race, the new biology holds that races have natural properties that are common to most members of that race. These natural properties give us no reason to think that any intellectual, moral, or behavioral characteristics can be attributed to races in virtue of shared natural properties. While there are many possible accounts of which natural properties could be used to define race, one approach that has gained a following is to think of races as partially defined or caused by reproductively isolated breeding populations. What's that? Well, a population is a group of the same species that live in the same place. What makes a population a breeding population is that members of this group can and do sexually reproduce. However, there are a few things that could make a breeding population reproductively isolated. One way is that the breeding population is geographically cut off from other breeding populations of their own species. For instance, you can imagine a group of people cut off from others because they live on an island or are separated by mountains or deserts. In this case, geographic properties of our world would shape our natural properties. Another way a breeding population could be reproductively isolated is that even though a population is located together and could interbreed, portions of that population don't interbreed with other portions. For instance, if there were cultural taboos about subgroups of wealthy or short individuals breeding with subgroups of poor or tall individuals respectively, those subgroups could be reproductively isolated even if they live in the same location. In this case, social elements of our world would shape our natural properties. So that's what reproductively isolated breeding populations are. But how might they be used to define race? One way is that we can often define race in terms of ancestral relations. For instance, if someone is of a particular race, let's call it race X, we can explain conditions for that individual being of that race. If one's parents are both of race X, then one is also of race X. Now you might see a couple of problems here. First, what happens when one parent is of race X, but another parent is of race Y? In this case, we might have to say that the offspring are either a new race, say race Z, or don't have a race as they are the product of non-isolated breeding populations. Second, even if one's parents are both members of race X, what makes them members of that race? The answer is that their parents were also of race X. But now we're off in an infinite regress. The explanation of what makes someone a member of a race is not answered, but just pushed back a generation each time that question gets asked. We need an explanation that stops the infinite regress. One of two answers is normally given here. One option is to say that one's ancestor is a member of race X in virtue of sharing simple phenotypic or observable properties specific to other members of one's reproductively isolated breeding population. The second option is to say that one's ancestor is a member of race X in virtue of sharing similar genotypic or genetic properties specific to other members of one's reproductively isolated breeding population. Given that much of our genetic makeup plays no direct role in our observable traits, the genotypic similarities would not necessarily mean that races have phenotypic similarities. So the accounts I just sketched, which make use of ancestral relations among reproductively isolated breeding populations, and either genotypic or phenotypic properties, is one way to develop a naturalist account of race. For now, I'll leave it to you to think about how such a view can deal with the problems I outlined in the first video, the domain problem, the expertise and deference problem, and the mismatch problem. I should note that in an attempt to be quite inclusive of a variety of naturalist theories, I have not specified the different ways this account can be developed in order to respond to various concerns. For three accounts that make use of the naturalist ideas sketched here, see Philip Kitcher's Race, Ethnicity, Biology, and Culture, Robin Andreessen's The Meaning of Race, Folk Conception and the New Biology of Race, and Quashon Spencer's A Radical Solution to the Race Problem. And for an attack on naturalist accounts, see Joshua Glasgow's On the New Biology of Race. In part three, we'll discuss social theories of race.
We're going to pause for a quick break.
Would you like to get updates on your smartphone in an emergency, even if a cell tower is down? It is possible if the FM chip is activated in your phone. Visit freeradioonmyphone.ca to see how you can get involved by contacting your carrier and signing our petition.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 FM, Vancouver, Canada. And we're back. Next, we have an explainer on what is a social historical construct. Let's listen and find out what it is.
Is race something we can explain in terms of social and historical features of our world? I'm David Miguel Gray, and welcome to part 3 of our series on Racial Ontology, A Guide for the Perplexed. In the first part, we discuss 3 general problems that make giving an account of race difficult. In part 2 of this series, I looked at a particular set of theories we can call naturalist theories of race. In part 3, we will look at different kind of theory that places social and historical properties at the center of our concept of race. Given the complexity of this topic, part 3 will have 2 sections. In the first section, I'll discuss just what it means to think of things in the world as socially constructed categories. In the second section, we will look at features common to socio-historical theories of race, as well as some examples of socio-historical properties. Social properties are those that are dependent on human actions and decisions, as opposed to physical properties, which are not dependent on such actions and decisions. In the last video, I used the example of the Great Sphinx of Giza to clarify the distinction between physical and social properties. The property of being made of limestone is a natural property of the statue. Limestone isn't something that is the result of human actions or decision-making, even if we classified it as limestone. However, the fact that this object is a statue is not a natural property. The fact that the limestone is in the shape of a crouching sphinx is the result of human actions and decision-making. To simplify things, let's take limestone, which is primarily calcium carbonate, and call that a natural kind. Let's call statues a social kind. Before moving on, I want to make the following 2 clarifications. First, someone might think that since we label and classify virtually everything we encounter, everything is the result of human actions and decisions. It is true that if we didn't exist, there would be no labeling of things. But the issue for us is whether or not the distinctions we draw when we categorize and label things are already there in nature or the result of human history and social institutions. For instance, we might ask, if human categorization never occurred, would there still be electrons in elephants or gravity in gold? Now contrast that question with, if human categorization never occurred, would there be cups in card games or planets in paperweights? I think the answer to the first question is yes, and the answer to the second question is no. The mere fact that we do categorize people into races doesn't settle the issue of whether or not races are a natural or social kind. The second clarification I want to make is that an individual object may not be classified as just a natural kind or just a social kind. Like our Sphinx example, we can talk about the object as falling into the natural kind limestone as well as the social kind statue. Given this, someone who thinks races are socio-historical constructions could think that an individual person falls into a natural kind like Homo sapiens while falling into a social kind, which is a racial category like white or East Asian. Defenders of a naturalistic theory of race would most likely claim that both the categories Homo sapiens as well as racial categories are natural kinds. Now that I have distinguished natural kinds and social kinds, I'd like to introduce 2 sorts of social kinds. Some social kinds are the result of us making things. Statues, stadiums, doctors, diplomats, boxing, and ballet are all things we make, and we can call these kinds of things artifacts. Artifacts are characterized primarily in terms of what they can do as opposed to what they are made out of. For instance, we would primarily characterize a coffee cup in terms of it being able to hold liquid and not in terms of what it is made out of. In addition to the things just mentioned, artifacts can be understood quite broadly. Political and legal institutions, money, and state-sanctioned gender and race-based discrimination are all the results of us making things. Other social kinds result from categorizing things that, unlike artifacts, are already found in nature. Additionally, these social kinds categorize things in virtue of natural differences, while the categories themselves are social. That might be a little confusing, so let me give you a couple of examples. First, here's an example from meteorology. Tropical depressions, tropical storms, and hurricanes are all characterized as low-pressure weather formations with accompanying thunderstorms that produce circular wind patterns. The speed of the wind patterns is a natural property of such weather formations and can vary greatly. We can characterize these wind speeds as being below 39 miles per hour, between 39 and 73 miles per hour, and 74 miles per hour or above. There's nothing special about those particular speeds. We just chose where to mark the difference. So these are cases of things in nature being distinguished in terms of their natural properties while being classified according to our interests. Call them naturally based kinds. Let's contrast this social kind with one that tracks a natural distinction. For instance, the precious metal gold can be characterized as having the atomic number of 79. Platinum atoms have 78 protons, and mercury has 80. Unlike tropical depressions, tropical storms, and hurricanes, the distinction between numbers of protons is not arbitrary, and is a distinction that we can find in nature, independent of our human actions and decisions. What I hope to have shown is that, in the category of social kinds, artifacts like teapots are quite easily spotted as a social kind, while tempests, like tropical storms and depressions, might initially appear to be natural kinds, but are grouped in such a way that the collections of natural properties are arbitrarily selected, making them social kinds. This point isn't itself just a tempest in a teapot. It is very important in understanding at least one version of the socio-historical account of race, one composed primarily or entirely of natural properties which were arbitrarily clustered together in light of human interests and actions. So one important question to think about is, could different races, say white, South Asian, and East Asian, be distinct natural kinds like mercury, gold, and platinum? Or alternatively, may races be more like tropical storms, tropical depressions, and hurricanes? That is, defined in terms of natural properties that are separated by artificial boundaries based on human interests and decisions. There could be several other types of social kinds aside from the ones I just mentioned, but I think this initial distinction is sufficient for us to go on and talk about different properties that social kinds have. First, you probably noticed that a lot of social kinds and social properties have to do with human interests. This means that when we create social kinds, they are often created with a function in mind. We make statues because they are beautiful, or to worship gods, or to express ourselves. We classify things as precious metals because we can invest in them or use them for trade. In the case of artifacts, they are created to serve a particular function or interest. While a coffee cup can't be made out of just anything, it needn't be made out of any particular material to be the kind of thing that it is. Similarly, by giving certain people properties like medical training, you make people into doctors and use them to help us when we get ill. But sometimes, things naturally have properties that we can use for other purposes. Take the Mississippi River. While the river has many natural properties, such as being made of water and having a certain shape, which changes over time, it served initially to determine the political boundaries between Iowa, Missouri, Arkansas, and Louisiana on the western bank, and Illinois, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Mississippi on the eastern bank. The fact that it has natural properties which can be used as a way to politically divide some U.S. states is to use a natural feature of our world for social purposes. If you've ever used a rock as a paperweight, you've also used natural properties for social purposes. Okay, one last distinction. You might draw a distinction between social kinds that are clearly demarcated versus those that are not. Let's start with institutionally sanctioned social properties. Some social properties are the result of consensus by those in power. Being a doctor or being naturalized citizens are dependent upon the events of passing exams or being sworn in as a citizen, respectively. Being a doctor or being a naturalized citizen are also the result of the institutions which create these categories and make such events possible. Similarly, the rules of sports and the rules of the road are not up for debate, even though their respective governing bodies could decide to change the rules. Let's now contrast these social kinds, which are the result of formalized institutions and practices, with three sorts of social kinds around which there may be debate. First, whether we are considered fashionable or not is not the result of state-sanctioned institutions or even widespread agreement among the fashion community. While we sometimes joke about the fashion police and often agree about what is unfashionable, there could be reasonable debate over whether or not someone is fashionable. The same goes for other social properties like being weird, wise, talented, or tormented. Second, there are social kinds and social properties which result unintentionally from social practices, regardless of whether they are the result of formalized institutions or not. Accelerated global warming might be one example. Third, social kinds and properties can also be the result of covert, or at least not easily recognizable, social practices. These might include seeing the disparity in sentencing for crack versus cocaine possession as racist, the persistence of Jim Crow-style laws in America, and the social underpinnings of the gender wage gap. Let's recap. First, we introduced the distinction between natural kinds like gold or limestone and social kinds like statues and doctors. Second, we introduced a distinction between social kinds which might be artifacts and those that might be naturally based kinds, while noting that there could be other social kinds that we haven't covered. Third, we know that many social kinds are used for some purpose or function. Fourth, we noted that while there is a lot of consensus concerning some social kinds, properties, and practices, others are much more disputed. And finally, we noted that in cases where we are disputing what social kinds there are, or need to uncover social properties, kinds, and practices, there is important investigative work that needs to be done by people who work within the relevant social domains, such as sociologists, historians, legal scholars, and philosophers. This raises two problems for our first video, the domain problem and the expertise and deference problem. If it turns out that races are socio-historical kinds, in virtue of having socio-historical properties, then part of the domain of race studies will need to fall within the fields outside of the natural sciences. But if this is so, we still need to figure out what type of social kinds races are.
Lastly, how is race a social historic construct? Let's listen and learn.
Is race something we can explain in terms of social and historical features of our world? I'm David Miguel Gray. Welcome to the second section of part 3 of our series on racial ontology, A Guide for the Perplexed. In the first section of part 3, I discuss just what it means to think of things in the world as being social kinds as opposed to natural kinds. I also laid out some common features of socially constructed categories. In the second section, part 3b, we will look at features common to socio-historical theories of race, as well as some examples of socio-historical properties. Given our new and better understanding of social properties and social kinds, we're now in an excellent position to get back to our initial question, is race something we can explain in terms of social and historical features of our world? If races are not entirely the products of nature, that means that races are, in part or in whole, products of human actions or decision-making processes. We can investigate and discover things about races, but these investigations are social and historical investigations, quite unlike the investigations in the natural sciences. As such, in order for a socio-historical account of race to be correct, you must show both that races exist and at least one property that goes into forming the right concept of race has to be social. Recall our comparison in the last video between naturally based kinds, like tropical storms and depressions, and one potential account of races. This showed that even if races are defined totally in terms of natural properties, if the way we group racial properties is arbitrarily or not defined by natural differences, that grouping is a social property, thus making races social kinds. That being said, most of those who adopt a socio-historical theory of races think that races have other socio-historical properties as well. We should note that thinking of races as defined as social kinds rather than natural kinds leads to an important difference between these two kinds of theories. For socio-historical theories of race, what counts as racial properties will not be a universal feature of the race, as it will for naturalist theories. Rather, racial properties will be localized to the communities in which these properties are constructed. To put it differently, since the concept of race emerges among a group of people, given the people present in that community and the goals and interests of that community, racial concepts could vary in different communities or in the same community at different times. One real-world upshot of racial properties being local is that if you live in a country where one race concept is used, and you travel to another country that uses a different race concept, that new community might consider you to be of a different race. So if racial properties are determined locally, a point in favor of a socio-historical theory of race would be if we could find social properties that are present in a race concept in one location, but not in another. Another point in favor of a socio-historical theory would be if we could show that certain properties were either added